In this hour of the program, we will talk some about the way that the world, but specifically the United States, has responded to human rights crises over the past few years. And our guest for the program is John Shattuck. He was, during the period of the Clinton administration, an official that was charged with looking after the issue of human rights. He was the Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor between 1993 and 1998. After that, he served as the U.S. Ambassador to the Czech Republic for 2 years between 1998 and 2000. Currently, he is Chief Executive Officer of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation in Boston. He is the author of a recently published book, which is titled Freedom on Fire. The subtitle is Human Rights Wars and America's Response. It is published by the Harvard University Press and looks specifically at four cases and how the United States performed, those being Bosnia, Rwanda, Haiti, and China. Some cases where we were successful, others not. And he looks at the reasons why and why not. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. The number, if you're here where we are in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, if that makes it any easier, and generally it doesn't, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point here, calls are welcome. We just ask people to be brief, just so that we can keep the program moving and accommodate as many different people as possible. Mr. Shattuck, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
Very glad to be on the show.
It is the case that since the end of the Cold War, it seems that we have seen a great upsurge in violence that is, in its nature, political, religious, and ethnic. And certainly those things in the world are not new, but we have seen an awful lot of it in recent decades. And that prompts the question whether, in fact, we are simply paying more attention or whether there actually is more of this kind of violence and has been in the post-Cold War era than there was before.
Well, I think it's both, in fact. We are paying more attention, and there is more violence. And the violence, particularly ethnic, racial, and religious conflict, is a product of what I call the forces of disintegration that are at work in the world after the end of the Cold War. Just to be clear that I'm not totally pessimistic, I also look at the forces of integration, which involve more communication and the expansion of democracies and since the end of the Cold War. But the forces of disintegration come about as a result of the breakup and failure of states like Yugoslavia after the communist empire fell, and they come about as a result of the kind of cynical leadership that you get in countries, again, like Yugoslavia, where Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tudjman, two former communist leaders, fanned the flames of ethnic conflict in order to advance their own causes, and that went on to create genocide in our time. The numbers are quite staggering. If you look at the number of people killed inside their own countries since 1989, it's a staggering number of about 5.5 million people. About 30 million refugees have emerged in this period as a result of these kinds of conflicts. And some $30 billion of taxpayer dollars have been spent on peacekeeping and humanitarian assistance. And of course, since 9/11, we've seen the rise of terrible concerns about terrorism and the worldwide threats that come from that. One of the things that I argue in my book is that what I call human rights wars, which are these ethnic, racial, and religious conflicts, which come about after the forces of disintegration go to work. In many ways, these are the breeding grounds of terrorism. So we should do more than ever before to promote human rights and the solution to these conflicts in order to in the long term, reduce factors that produce terrorism.
Certainly the United States has been criticized by many people who work in the field of human rights for failing to act more often than not. And in cases where finally the United States does take action, the country has been criticized for waiting such a long time till things got so bad that they were impossible to ignore. And the criticism seems to be that the United States government, and not just this government, has defined its interests so narrowly that it makes it possible to look at one of these situations, Rwanda, for example, and to say, well, really, we have no interests there. It does not matter to us. And for that reason, we don't want to expend any political capital to get involved. And furthermore, people in government have this perception that your average American doesn't think that it's particularly important, and that for the government, there essentially is no price to be paid for doing nothing, and the possibility that if we do something and it goes wrong, there will be a price to pay. So the safer course for people in government, it seems to be, the safer course is do nothing, because we know there it really won't cost us anything, and that we think that we have nothing at stake there.
Well, I argue in my book that the cost of doing nothing is very high. And in fact, 9/11 reflects the nature of that cost. And certainly the cost in dollars in terms of humanitarian assistance and peacekeeping coming in after terrible violence has occurred is very high. The figure I just quoted of about $30 billion that's been spent just on these mop-up activities. And then the cost economically is very high. Regions of the world that get destabilized by human rights wars, as happened in southeastern Europe, and of course that whole region is still deeply affected by what happened in Bosnia. What happened in Afghanistan for 10 years as a regime that was waging war against the civilian population harbored al-Qaeda. And al-Qaeda then, of course, became the terrorist source of our own terrible the attacks of 9/11. So the costs are high, and our national security interest is great in trying to solve these problems before they get out of hand. And that's what I argue in my book. And I think those are the lessons of the human rights wars of the 1990s, the fact that we did not stop the genocide in Rwanda, as tragically costly in lives and in the destabilization of that whole region of Africa continuing. I was in the Congo this summer, and you can still feel the reverberations of the Rwanda genocide that happened almost 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's a case where people argue that there may indeed be costs of involvement, but it gets more difficult, it gets more costly the longer you wait. So, and
right,
you make that the same argument, that what we really ought to be doing is we ought to be paying attention what's going on various places around the world. Look for early warning signs. So if you're going to decide to intervene, better sooner than later. And here was a case where perhaps when we really started paying attention, it was almost too late. And of course, back in 1994, something like 800,000 people were killed in a relatively short period of time during this genocide. You argue that, in fact, that it didn't need to happen. It could have been prevented.
Right. Yes, it could have been prevented. It could have been prevented by even some alert peacekeeping that would have taken the warning signs, as the very courageous general, the Canadian general, Romeo Dallaire, who was in charge of the UN peacekeeping force at the time in Rwanda, sought instructions from the UN headquarters in New York to be able to disarm the people who were planning the genocide. And he knew where their arms, he had been tipped off about where they were beginning to stockpile arms and machetes in particular. But he was denied the authority to go ahead with that, because typically peacekeeping is just kind of watching over a situation. Well, we've learned the hard way in Rwanda and Bosnia that peacekeeping has to be much more aggressive and forceful, and you have to take action to send signals to those who were planning genocide that there will be a price to pay.
In the book, you talk about the fact that one of the things that you have to understand about the way government works, and maybe specifically about the way the State Department works, is that we have ranked various parts of the world according to how important to us they are. And I believe that on this list that Europe is on the top and Africa is on the bottom. And here now would be a case where something was happening, maybe we got some inkling of it, but we said this is so far down on our list that it's not as significant to us as, say, Bosnia, although there it took us a long time to do anything about it either. I guess the question I'm getting at is how is it that we, as the United States, go about deciding when something that's happening in another country really matters enough to us so that we're going to get involved and perhaps even put American lives on the line?
Well, during the time I was in government, this ranking that you described was really changing. I think that ranking was a Cold War ranking, if you will. And as we got to this new era and market economics were spreading as well as democracy, we began to look at parts of the world as some parts as more important than they had been in the past. And I think we also slowly began to change the definition of national security as it became clear that these catastrophic wars against civilians in places like Rwanda and Bosnia were having a high cost. And that's why, ultimately, there was an effective intervention, not only in Bosnia, but in Kosovo, and I would also cite Haiti, although Haiti, tragically, we didn't stay long enough, and the country slipped back, but Haiti was also a human rights catastrophe. So, how do we make these choices? Well, I think there's always competition for time in Washington for different kinds of interests. And I, during the time that I was in Washington, I saw the competition begin to favor somewhat more human rights and conflict resolution. I worry now that with the preoccupation in the way in which the war on terrorism is being waged, human rights have been moved to the back burner and in some cases have been violated by this war. In the way it's being prosecuted, particularly in terms of the erosion of civil liberties in the United States.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others. Let me introduce very quickly, again, our guest. John Shattuck served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor from 1993 until 1998. This was at the time when Bill Clinton was president. He also served as U.S. Ambassador to the Czech Republic from 98 to 2000. Currently, he is Chief Executive Officer of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation in Boston. He's the author of a book that explores the subject. It's titled Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars and America's Response, published by the Harvard University Press. And the questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to start out with in Champaign County on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Your case studies were, again, they include the Yugoslavian region and then Rwanda. What were the other two? Just those are the two I'm interested in. But
Haiti and China.
Ah. Okay, well, the latter two could require a lot of explanation. But the things that you've said about the Congo, I mean, Rwanda being a factor in the Congo certainly is true, but the Congo, you know, one has to look at U.S. policy prior to the end of the Cold War, the machinations, you know, alliance with South Africa, the fight in Angola, the way Congo was used as a staging ground for the armies of, you know, so there's a legacy there that predates this image that it's merely a human rights war. I think it's a product of U.S. foreign policy. That, and you one could say, well, we were just countering the Soviets. But I think that actually the Cold War was a bit of a charade, particularly the way it worked out in the Third World. We were both using it as the U.S. and the Soviet Union were using it as a pretext, basically, for resource wars. But I don't expect an agreement on that. But you've talked about these forces of disintegration, but you don't really specify what it is. When you referred to Yugoslavia, you talked about, you know, the end of the communist empire. Well, you know, Yugoslavia, South Slavia, was already fairly out of the sphere of the Soviet Union well before the breakup, and so it seems to me one has to look to other explanations for the disintegration. And I think what I would count as a force of disintegration, you might count as a force of integration, which is economic liberalization and so-called free trade and the way that the IMF and the World Bank, which are commented on widely in Africa, but its role in Yugoslavia and the breakup there, the economic basis, I'm not an economic determinist, but I think there's a big lack of discussing the economic role of the breakup of Yugoslavia that is probably not accidental, but I suppose you might have some reactions to those two general lines of discourse.
Well, it's certainly true that the roots of these conflicts are deep, and they differ in nature from place to place. And we take first Congo and the genocide in Rwanda. The roots, the deepest roots, and in many ways the ones that caused the conflict are the roots of colonial, the way in which the colonial empires were managed, and choice by the colonial powers of certain minorities in those countries, particularly in Rwanda, the Tutsi minority, to become a leadership group, and then a rank discrimination against the population at large, and the whole way in which the colonial process played itself out ended up being, as I argue in the book, one of the root causes of the genocide in Rwanda. You've also got, to be sure, foreign policy during the Cold War. I have no question that different ways in which the Cold War was fought out and played out in Central Africa caused the rise of a very corrupt state headed by Mobutu in Congo, in what was then Zaire, as he called it. And so there are many malefactors here, to be sure, and historically, and yet I think we need to have policies that address these conflicts not only in their root but also in their immediate manifestation, which is why we need a much more effective way of getting early warning and understanding the conflicts and trying to stop them before they emerge, and a change in policy. In the case of Yugoslavia, there's no question, again, as the caller suggests, that Yugoslavia was largely out of the communist empire in a kind of formal sense, and held together by a strong leader who was also an authoritarian and who managed to balance the various ethnic groups off against each other. And then, at the end, he was succeeded by a series of leaders who themselves were corrupt and tried to use the ethnic differences in order to be able to jockey for position, people like Milosevic and Tudjman, for example. So the caller is right. The causes are different from one place to the next, but we need to address these conflicts, and it is very much in our national and in international security interests, and I argue that we should do this multilaterally, not as the U.S. operating alone, as the current administration seems to be doing in Iraq or is doing in Iraq. So we need to have an approach that understands the history and also looks at the immediate causes of the conflict as well, and tries to stop them before they get out of hand and become genocides, as they have in several cases in the world.
There's a specific anecdote that I heard from Randall Robinson, quite a cute observer of Africa, Trans-Africa founder, and he says that there was one point in the lead-up to the non-intervention in Rwanda where the U.S. was talking about sending in people. There was also a Ghanaian force that was ready to go, but the U.S. wasn't willing to, you know, help pay for it in any way. But the anecdote about the U.S. forces was that the U.S., and this was under Clinton and it was on your watch, forces didn't want to go in as blue helmets. Now, they would have supposedly gone in as U.S. troops. Now, that could be just a ruse, but it does indicate that the U.S., even under Clinton, was eschewing, it seems to me, that it was eschewing U.N. Multilateralism at that time. And it may have been, you know, they wouldn't have gone in even under the regular order, but that this was a way of saying, well, we can't do it as U.N. troops. We don't want to do it at all.
Yes. I mean, the Rwanda case is an unconscionable failure by the United States and by other countries to address what was a genocide developing. In the case of the United States, there were a couple of reasons why this failure tragically occurred. One was that just before the Rwanda genocide, there was the failure of a peacekeeping operation in Somalia and the killing of 18 U.S. Rangers and the dragging of the body of one ranger through the streets of Mogadishu by the guerrilla forces, and that was played on CNN and caused an enormous outcry in the United States, particularly in the Congress, which insisted on changing U.S. relationship to U.N. peacekeeping operations. The second reason was, I think, as the caller suggests, there was a strong reaction in the United States against the U.N., not in the Clinton administration, but in the Congress. Senator Helms, for 5 years, held hostage the U.N. and refused to pay to authorize the payment of U.S. dues to the U.N. So that with the roots of U.S. unilateralism and isolationism lie deep in the post Cold War period. They're not just today in what we're seeing in the Iraq in terms of unilateralism. So this failure in Rwanda was a tragedy because it happened so soon after Somalia, which had traumatized the U.S. Congress on the subject of peacekeeping.
We are at our midpoint here. I want to thank the last caller and encourage others, if you'd like to be a part of the conversation, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Our guest is John Shattuck. He served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor from 1993 until 1998. This was in the Clinton administration. He also then was U.S. Ambassador to the Czech Republic for 2 years between 1998 and 2000. Currently, he is Chief Executive Officer of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation in Boston and has also had positions at Harvard University, and also way back before then, he began his public service career at the American Civil Liberties Union, where he was executive director of the ACLU Washington office and also served as ACLU National Staff Counsel from 1971 until 1984. He writes about this subject here we're discussing in his book, Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars and America's Response. His book is published by the Harvard University Press. And again, questions, comments are welcome. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about Haiti. Here is a case where the argument you seem to be making is it started off promisingly enough, but that there was a lack of commitment and ultimately a lack of follow-through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Haiti is worth just a sentence or two to distinguish it from the Bosnia and Rwanda cases because it was so close to our shores and it became a domestic issue. This is back in 1994, after the Rwanda genocide, and there was a rethinking going on of how we should respond to these crises, and then all of a sudden we've got a human rights catastrophe right near our shores, and thousands and thousands of Haitian refugees trying to escape in small boats and come to Florida. So that caused a domestic, to put this on the domestic screen, And in this case, President Clinton, working closely with other countries in the hemisphere, assembled a multinational force to go into Haiti with what we call diplomacy backed by force, because there was a negotiation to remove the military dictatorship which had overthrown President Aristide, the democratically elected president, and return President Aristide to office. And that was successful, and it was the first case of a post-Cold War humanitarian intervention. Tragically, though, there was continuing strong opposition in the United States Congress, particularly in the Senate, to this kind of use of U.S. military power behind a to deal with a human rights crisis. And the multinational force was withdrawn after 6 months. The Congress did not vote the kind of assistance package. I mean, nothing remotely resembling what they've just voted for Iraq. And so there wasn't the kind of a nation building and follow-up and reconstruction that needed to take place. Haiti is still a better place than it was before 1994, but it is by no means a total success.
We have another caller here, and the caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I've got two related questions. In the case of China, when there are human rights violations there, what kind of leverage does the United States have with them? And in another case, let's say with violations in Egypt or Saudi Arabia, what can the United States do about that?
Mm-hmm. Very good questions. I mean, in the case of China, of course, here you have a competition of interests in the United States, and by far the stronger interests tend to be the economic and trade relations issues, and that played out very much during the Clinton period, although President Clinton probably took a more aggressive approach toward using U.S. leverage with economic leverage with China to try to get changes in human rights policy after the Tiananmen Square massacres of 1989. But within a year, he backed down and changed his policy, largely under pressure from U.S. economic interests that said, please don't do anything that's going to get in the way of our efforts to expand our markets in China. So China is a big, obviously, world power, and you ask what kind of leverage the United States has. Well, I think it has leverage working with other countries working with the kind of exchange programs and efforts to improve the rule of law, but it's much more difficult to use the kind of economic leverage that was attempted in the Clinton period, and then that was reversed. In the case, and I also think that over time, China hopefully will improve its overall situation on human rights as a result of the the growth of its economic system. But that remains to be seen. We haven't seen a lot of clear evidence of that. In the case of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, other countries which have been allies of the U.S., I think it's tragic that essentially the alliances that get struck in the Middle East, in particular, have led to a loss of leverage on human rights and an unwillingness to confront some of these bigger problems. And I think we've now learned very much the hard way from the terrorism crisis of today and the complete corruption of a lot of the Middle East leadership in terms of human rights, to say nothing of economic corruption, that it's important to work with civil society elements in those countries for reform of the system. Otherwise, there's no outlet for people in those systems, and the competition comes from the madrasas and the terrorist groups that recruit young people out of those systems, which is why I think in the end promoting human rights and democracy has to be a central feature of any effort to protect the world against terrorism.
Does that call that get at your question?
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, I thank you, and we'll go on to somebody else here. We'll go to Urbana and caller on line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I was reading a article in the New Statesman, which had an interesting take on human rights, minority rights, and I just thought I'd ask you for your view on this. It was last year by a fellow called Mark Mazower, and he argued that that the League of Nations was concerned with minority rights to a large degree, and actually gave had teeth in that concern, and then the League of Nations kind of failed when it, you know, for a variety of reasons, but that countries like the U.S. welcome a shift between concerns with minority rights to human rights, because under the UN, there's no real teeth in that in the charter for one country intervening in the affairs of another in terms of human rights. And when you think about the way the U.S. likes to pick and choose where it's, you know, where it starts, you know, complaining about human rights violations, whereas, you know, it supports, I mean, it turns a blind eye when it's done in its own interests. You know, it seems to support that idea. So I was just wondering if you were familiar with that idea, and whether you had a comment in reference to it. And I'll hang up and listen if the question is clear.
Well, let me see if I understand the question. I mean, I think one aspect of your question is what is authorized under international law to enforce human rights, and another aspect of the question is. Is there a conflict between minority rights and human rights more broadly described? And I guess a third aspect is, what about U.S. picking and choosing in different situations? You know, on the first, the international law is very clear on the subject of genocide. Genocide, which is what happened in Rwanda and what happened in Bosnia and Yugoslavia and Kosovo. There is a convention ratified by the United States and some 120 other countries that calls for the elimination of genocide and authorizes member states, those who have those who signed the Genocide Convention, to take action together to stop a genocide in progress. This is also authorized under the UN Charter. So there's really no lack of clarity on that very specific point, stopping a genocide. In fact, I argue in the book that it's really the obligation of states to do it. It's not just that they're authorized, they're really obligated to do it. I think on the question of conflict between minority rights and human rights, I don't personally see it that way. I think minority rights are very, very important, because if they're not protected, they can lead to genocide. If you have a state that purports to be a democracy, but it does nothing to protect its minorities, as, for example, Germany under Hitler, who was, after all, elected, the result is catastrophic. And the same was true in Rwanda, and the same was true in Bosnia. So minorities must be protected under overall human rights law, and there has to be, for a democracy to really work, there have to be protections written into their constitution for minorities. It is true on the third point that that the U.S. Is often picking and choosing where it exercises its authority. That is what happens in almost any sovereign state. But I would like to believe, and I'm hopeful, at least I was from the period that I was in government, that we were learning lessons, especially about the subject of genocide, that we could not pick and choose, that we had to work with other countries to take action to stop conflicts that might ultimately lead to genocide, and that we should do that wherever we are. And I argue that if we don't do that, working with other countries, we're only going to see more terrorism.
We have, again, here about 10 minutes left in the program. Our guest is John Shattuck. He served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor during the Clinton administration. This was from 1993 until 1998. He also spent 2 years after that as the U.S. Ambassador to the Czech Republic. He has authored a book titled Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars, and America's Response. It's published by the Harvard University Press, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222. I've mentioned the fact that the book looks at four kind of case studies of intervention or failure of intervention, Rwanda, Haiti, Bosnia, China. The one that seems to be offered as the case of the greatest success is in the former Yugoslavia, although I guess if people wanted to offer criticism, one that might come up is the question of why it is the United States waited so long.
Well, that's an extremely good question, and there was a huge policy debate inside the United States government for the first 2 years of the Clinton administration. During the Bush administration, first Bush administration, when for 2 years the conflict in Yugoslavia was raging and nothing was done, I think the Bush administration was looking at Yugoslavia through the lens of the Cold War, and Secretary of State James Baker famously said in 1991, we have no dog in that fight, when he was asked what the U.S. was going to do to try to stop the disintegration of Yugoslavia, simply thinking that there wasn't any strategic interest there. Well, that certainly turned out not to be true. In the case of the Clinton period of 2 years before aggressive action was finally taken in summer of 1995, the policy was changed and the war was stopped, and humanitarian intervention occurred. In those previous 2 years, there was a feeling inside the administration that this was a conflict that could be addressed by the Europeans. European peacekeeping forces were on the ground. There was also there were many views both in the administration and in the Congress that what was happening in Yugoslavia was the product of ancient hatreds, that is, you know, ethnic hatred that had gone back for centuries, and there wasn't anything that could be done about it. People like me and Dick Holbrooke and others in the administration who were fighting to change the policy kept pointing out that there may well have been ethnic and religious differences in the country, and there are today, but they were being fanned into crimes and conflict by Milosevic and Tudjman and others. And we produced reports on that, and finally in 1995 we prevailed.
One of the bottom lines here, and we talked a little bit about it earlier, was that for effective intervention to take place in these kinds of human rights wars, it can't just be the United States.
Right.
It's got to be an international kind of operation. And it seems to be sometimes very difficult for countries, individual countries, to put aside their own interests, and often they are competing interests, to get together to agree on some kind of strategy. And, you know, for example, you can point to the former war in the former Yugoslavia as an example. Because, as you point out, I think this was back when the first Bush, Mr. Bush, was the president of the United States. The our allies in Europe basically told us to buzz off. They said, "Look, this is our sphere of influence. We'll take care of this. This is none of your business." And the United States government perhaps thought, "Well, that's true. It is none of our business." But also, they were also telling us it was none of our business. You know, how does one get to the point where you can manage to get enough nations who do have competing interests to agree, first of all, to do anything, and then, secondly, on what to do?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is certainly true that that this was left to a European sphere of influence, and the Europeans were saying this is really our problem and let us solve it. And ultimately, the Europeans were desperate and asked you for U.S. intervention. As approximately 200,000 people were killed in Yugoslavia in the 4 years before 1995. My view and what I argue in this book is that we have a great national security interest in developing alliances to work on human rights problems. And sometimes those alliances can be as broad as the United Nations. Sometimes they're going to be regional alliances like NATO or the OAS, as in the case of Haiti. But we need to work with other countries, and we need to address these problems before they get out of hand. And I think if we have a spirit of leadership in this country, we are by far the strongest power in the world today, and we ought to exercise that power, but we ought to exercise it to lead in a multilateral world rather than saying it's our way or the highway. And frankly, I fear that the way in which we're proceeding today in our foreign policy is very unilateral. It's saying we're the strongest power and we have the answers. So anybody who wants to join us can, but otherwise it's going to be our show. That is not going to secure us over the long run. We need other countries. We need cooperation with intelligence services on terrorism. We need cooperation on economic issues. And the fact that we happen to be the strongest power on earth is all the more reason for us to work together with other countries to solve these problems.
We have several callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. Probably won't be able to do all of them, but we'll see. First up is someone on a cell phone, and that's on our line 3. Hello?
Yes, hi, how are you?
Good.
Hey, I know that we're short on time and we have other guests, so I'll try and be very brief here. Just a couple of quick questions for John, if that's okay.
Yes.
One is that I understand that the UN has a basic definition to human rights, and which necessarily doesn't incorporate all the elements of what in the U.S. we consider as a basic understanding of human rights. But if we took the definition of human rights and applied that to even the nations that are part of the UN, I wonder if we've done a priority list regarding that type of definition versus, say, what's generally considered U.S. interest. And the second part of that is if we took that, assumed the definition of terrorism, and what groups would fall from that terrorist group under the, say, the violated portion of the human rights definition. And the third question I have real quick is, you know, economic interest in the U.S. is a great motivator. I've actually seen some migration of industry to incorporating corporate social responsibility obligations to the areas that they're trying to obtain a footprint or a market position in. And if there's any type of market initiative within the U.S. to, say, include something like the FTSE for Good that is in the EU or something like that to provide these incentives for corporate social responsibility. So I know that's a lot of questions, and I hope I presented those okay for you.
Okay. Well, certainly it's very complicated. You can deal with whatever part of that you think you can.
Well, I'll just give a couple of very quick answers to a couple parts of that. On the question of, you know, the UN definition of human rights and our own Bill of Rights, the UN definition of human rights is both broader and narrower than our Bill of Rights. It's broader because it encompasses economic and social rights, that is basically the right to the basic necessities of life. We have not recognized that particularly in our Bill of Rights. It's a little narrower in that our own concept of freedom of speech is broader than you'll find in UN human rights area. But having said that, I think it's important, and we have incorporated some of the international human rights law directly into our own law by ratifying treaties, and we should probably continue to do that. I argue that in my book. The corporate responsibility question is a big one, and you could have a whole program around that. But I do think that that the private sector is an extremely important actor in the human rights area, and you were seeing more and more evidence that some private sector groups, particularly the apparel industry and some other industries, are aware of the fact that their offshore production can run into serious human rights problems and lead to consumer boycotts, and therefore they've begun to look at how they might develop codes of conduct for the way in which they operate overseas on issues like child labor, for example, or slave labor, trying to make sure that they aren't hiring those kinds of producers. So there's much more to be done, and I think the human rights community needs to work with the corporate community to promote human rights. Hmm.
We're just about the point where we're going to have to finish, and my apologies to the callers we can't take. Just as a way of rounding things out, I wonder, when you look at our record, not just of the United States, but of the United States and its friends around the world, it's not where we'd like to be. I think we failed to act more often than we have acted and succeeded. Does that make you generally optimistic or pessimistic when you think about our ability to deal with these kinds of conflicts in the future?
Well, yes, we have failed, but I think we are also, you know, we have a record of trying, and we've got to look in the very broad context of some of the things that we as a country have done and be proud of that and build on that. I mean, certainly our role in the Second World War, you know, our role belatedly in stopping the war in Bosnia, you know, our role working with other countries to promote human rights. This is a source of what I call soft power in the book. I mean, it's not the hard military power. It's the power, the ultimate power that the United States should have, which is to project with other countries a set of values having to do with the inherent rights that people have to be free from governments who are going to kill them or governments who are going to silence them. And that is a power that I'd like to see us exercise more. I worry that in the war on terrorism, we're losing that power because of the way we're prosecuting the war on terrorism. And in the end, if we don't support human rights and promote it and use our own best values to connect with our interests, we aren't going to win that war on terrorism.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Our guest, John Shattuck. He is the Chief Executive Officer of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation in Boston, also served as Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor in the Clinton administration between 93 and 98. His book, Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars and America's Response, published by the Harvard University Press.